Welcome back to New Books in Native American Studies. I'm Andrew Epstein, and thanks for listening to this podcast for the New Books Network. Each month, we pick a newly published work in Native American and Indigenous Studies and spend the hour speaking with the author. I came across today's book at a rather serendipitous moment. On a research trip to D.C. and Albany, New York, not long ago, I listened to the audiobook of Cormac McCarthy's Blood Meridian, or The Evening Redness in the West. For those of you familiar with the tale, you'll know it's not exactly pleasant listening for a leisurely drive. Blood Meridian is the classic revisionist Western, a story of the unspeakable violence at the heart of America's expansion in the Southwest. There's a tendency, of course, to chalk up the more brutal passages of McCarthy's novel as hyperbole, drawn more from the mind of its dark author than the historical record. Then you come across a book like the one I'll be discussing today, and you're confronted with the truth that violence isn't peripheral to manifest destiny, but its constitutive element. In 1872, as the U.S. sought to clear out the indigenous population of the newly incorporated territories in the Southwest, the military came upon an encampment of Yavapai Indians, sheltering under a rock overhang in a canyon above the Salt River in Arizona. The soldiers rained down bullet fire and boulders. A massacre. Everyone was killed. Well, almost everyone. A few days earlier, the advancing soldiers had come across a young boy, maybe 8 or 9, looking for a missing horse. He was alone, abandoned perhaps. The soldiers scooped him up. The American commander, Captain James Byrne, the one who ordered the boulders to be pushed down on the young boy's parents, aunts, uncles, siblings, and cousins just a few days later, adopted the young boy, naming him Mike Burns. Today I'll be speaking with Gregory McNamee, a prolific writer and editor who has published the autobiography of Mike Burns. What the dark revisionist Westerns like Blood Meridian so often miss is that even in the face of genocide, some survive, persist, and find ways to adapt to the changing world around them. Mike Burns was such a character. Living in two worlds, Mike Burns worked for the U.S. military as a scout in the campaign against Geronimo, but later returned to his Yavapai relatives to learn his culture. He traveled east for boarding school and back home as a farmer. He was a writer, an amateur anthropologist, a documentarian of sorts. His story is nothing short of incredible, and I'm so pleased to get the opportunity to discuss it with his insightful and respectful publisher, Gregory McNamee. I hope you enjoy our discussion. Gregory McNamee, welcome to New Books in Native American Studies.
Thank you very much, Andrew. I appreciate it.
Thanks. Well, today we'll be discussing the fascinating autobiography of Mike Burns that you edited and published with the University of Arizona Press. It's entitled The Only One Living to Tell, The Autobiography of a Yavapai Indian. Before we talk about Mike Burns, I'm hoping you can tell us a little bit about yourself, your own biography.
Well, I've been called a born editor, by which I think I mean that I can talk about any subject for about 3 minutes and then be completely out of things to say. So I'm a generalist. I came, into adult life by way of publishing, and have always worked in publishing for the last 35 years or so, 40 if you count a brief career in bookselling before then. So, but in all events, I've always been around books, and I have done 35 books prior to the Mike Burns story, and I'm a contributing editor to the Encyclopedia Britannica, where I write about world culture and geography and film and all kinds of things like that. And so I come into the work of doing Mike Burns' autobiography very much as a generalist, but with quite a lot of background in the history and the natural history of the Southwest. Mm. And so about 10 years ago, the then director of a little museum up in central Arizona, in the central Arizona highlands in a town called Prescott, came to me with this manuscript asking my advice both as a publisher and as a writer about what to do with it. And that's the Mike Burns, the beginning of the Mike Burns story as we know it today.
Wonderful. You've anticipated one of my questions, which is how you came to find out about Mike Burns. But we'll get back to his biography in a minute. I want to start by getting you to set the stage here a little bit for our listeners, and starting first with the Yavapai Indians, of which Mike Burns is one. Our listeners, especially those on the East Coast, might not be familiar with the Yavapai, and I'm hoping you can sort of lay out what you think is important to know going into this autobiography about not just the people themselves, but what they faced in the late 19th century.
Yeah, absolutely. The Yavapai, I don't think it would be unkind to say that they were kind of the poor cousins, the poor relations of the better known peoples of the Arizona Highlands. And by the Arizona Highlands, I mean the country between the low desert with the saguaro cacti that's so familiar to us from postcards, and then the very high Colorado plateau where the Grand Canyon is located. And in between that country lies a band of mountains and mesas and plateaus called the Arizona Highlands. John Gregory Bourke, who was a U.S. cavalry officer who figures in the Mike Burns story, had been posted once as a observer to the British Army in Afghanistan back in the 1850s, and he likened the country. He said it's as rough as Afghanistan. So it's very wild, very remote. The Yavapai people lived in very small bands, typically no more than 40 or 50 at a time, generally speaking, roaming through this country, and lived a very simple hunting and gathering is the classic anthropological phrase, really more gathering and hunting, because game was not especially abundant up there. The Yavapai people call themselves the Kuevkepaya, and there are four Paya bands in Arizona, or four Paya nations, and they are all related to the Pai people, Pai being a word meaning water, and the Pai, so the Pai Ute, for example, or the Havasupai, they're all related, but not so closely that they didn't go to war with each other from time to time. And finally, in all of this, when Anglos first came into the Yavapai territory in the early 1860s, in any kind of number, they had a tendency to group all Indians together. And so they called them Apaches, and sometimes they'd call them Yavapai Apaches, or sometimes they call them Tonto Apaches, or you know, Yuma Apaches, or Mojave Apaches. Whatever the case, they were not Apache people, but they were lumped together, and that, as the 19th century Indian wars progressed, worked very much to the disadvantage of the Yavapai people. When half of the U.S. Army was after the Apaches, Yavapai's often got in the way.
Hmm. Now, your preface to this work starts with a very haunting description of a particularly brutal, but unfortunately not altogether uncommon, massacre by American soldiers a few days before Christmas in 1872, about 100 miles northeast of present-day Phoenix, Arizona. What brought U.S. forces to the canyon at Salt River that day, and what happened?
Well, the once again, the army was basically trying to clear the interior, the highlands of Arizona, of Apache people. These in the 1870s were the first days of efforts to move Indian peoples onto reservations. And so all through the West, you had this military campaign to do that. And in fairness, I suppose, to the people who were doing the dirty work of rounding up Indian people, the argument that was made by the United States government was that it was for the protection of the Indians, because there were so many white settlers after the Civil War who were streaming westward and coming into Indian territory and shooting anything that moved, basically. And so it didn't, that was the stated mission, but of course, I mean, it really was, really and truly was a war on Native America. In all events, General George Crook and his command had been in charge of the Department of Arizona And John Gregory Bourke, whom I mentioned, was among the American military officers, all very brilliant strategists, tacticians, and warriors who had come west after the Civil War, most at that time in the early 1870s having fought in the Union Army. Later during the Apache Wars, a lot of ex-Confederate soldiers. But whatever the case, the U.S. Army was in the highlands trying to move, in this case, Yavapai people down out of the mountains and into the reservations. The Yavapai, I should say, happened, again, to their disadvantage, to live in country where gold strikes were being discovered, gold and silver strikes right and left. And so all of that by way of context to the fact that then the U.S. Army happened to find a band of Yavapai people who were sheltering in a place that has come to be called Skeleton Cave.
Now, you write that the incident was originally known as the Battle of the Caves, but you point out
yes.
that it's now more accurately known, more fairly known as the Skeleton Cave Massacre. I'm wondering, were you able to trace, or do you have any knowledge of how that revision in history or popular consciousness occurred to call it by its accurate name? And why is it? Why was it more of a massacre than a battle?
Well, it was a massacre to the extent that the Yavapai people, there were a few Yavapai men, and a few of them had guns, but most of them were women and children. And again, as I say, they were sheltering in this cave, and not a deep cave, just sort of an overhang more than anything else that extended back about 30 feet away from the Salt River and up on a cliff a couple of hundred feet above the river. So the cave was exposed to gunfire from above, and that's precisely where the army arrayed itself, on cliffs facing and above the cave, so that they were able to fire bullets in that were most of the damage was inflicted was ricocheting bullets off of the rocks. And to add injury to injury, the soldiers also rolled boulders down on top of the people who were below them. And so one of the interesting little side notes on that is another figure who pops up in Burns's autobiography is a man named Al Sieber, who is a German-born head of Indian Scouts. And Al Sieber was there on hand for this particular event, and again, as I say, they rolled boulders on top of these poor Indian people who were sheltering in the cave below. And years later, Al Sieber, who was then working as a foreman of a road construction crew building a road to what is now called Roosevelt Dam, died when somebody rolled a boulder on top of him.
Wow.
And it's thought that some of the Apaches who were working on the road crew may have done that.
Wow.
So,
some poetic justice.
Not necessarily instant karma, but karma all the same.
Yeah, absolutely. Is the incident widely known in Arizona today? I don't know if that's an ignorant question. I've never been to that part of the country, and I certainly know about some of the historical ignorance in my part of the country on the East Coast, but I'm wondering how that incident kind of plays into popular consciousness today, if at all.
I'm afraid it really doesn't at all. It's really very much unknown, and I think if you were to ask, I don't mean to sound unkind, but I think if you were to walk up to the average person on the street in Arizona and say, "Tell me about the Indian Wars here," that person may have heard of Geronimo, probably has heard of Geronimo, but that would probably exhaust that person's knowledge. And again, I don't mean to sound unkind by that. It's just that we have had a tendency. Condoleezza Rice, I was watching her the other day on Henry Gates's show having to do with ancestry on PBS, and she was saying that, you know, we as Americans, we have not reckoned yet with slavery, with the fact and the legacy of slavery. And I think that's also true of the Indian Wars, generally speaking. You know, we know a couple of kind of peg facts that we can hang our hats on. Okay, you know, Sitting Bull, and maybe Chief Joseph, and, oh yeah, Chief Seattle, that groovy guy that said nice things about living with the earth. Uh-huh. And, you know, maybe Tecumseh. Mm-hmm. And certainly Geronimo, but that's really about it. And so the facts of this massacre, and there were many, many others going on. The 1870s were a terribly bloody time throughout Arizona, and mostly one-sided. I mean, that is to say, for every settler or two that was killed by Indian attacks, there were 100 Indians who were killed by settler attacks.
Now, this book, this beautiful book that I have in my hand here, this autobiography of Mike Burns, he could have died at that massacre today, but he didn't. He survived. How did Burns, or and I'm going to pronounce this wrong, even though you told me how to pronounce it, Humutya, how did he come to survive this massacre, and what happened to him in the aftermath?
Homotia, which means wet nose in Kwevkepaya, and that which probably means runny nose. Andrew, the truth is that we don't really know why he survived. His account and that of the cavalry officers who found him differs ever so slightly. And I don't want to give away too much of the story by saying that, but there is some question about how the cavalry came to find the Indian band, and there's some thought that they found him because the little kid was out there looking for his family. Mm-hmm. And they just sort of followed him as he made his way to the cave. We don't know that for a fact. Whatever the case, yeah, he was out. You know, the main band of Kwevkepaya had established itself there at the cave, and people were still coming in from out in the countryside. You know, little ones and twos and fives of people. And so, in the case of Burns, he said that he and an uncle were coming in from foraging, basically gathering food out in the mountains nearby, when they were taken by cavalry, and the cavalry killed the uncle, and having already killed Burns's mother and father, and again, we don't know to historical precision any of this. There's a And I should sort of say in that there's a great deal in Burns's account that if you strictly added things up chronologically and compared it to the white kept historical record, there are points of divergence all the way through. And my tendency is to think, even if Burns isn't strictly accurate at some points, he believed that things happened the way they happened, and that's the important thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Okay. Now, you know, I want to leave a lot of the story, as you said, to the readers, but one of the most captivating things about this work that I'm hoping you can speak about broadly is the way in which you write that Burns is a character that inhabits two worlds. What do you mean by this? How did he deal with the or understand the competing forces on his identity? And we're fast forwarding a little bit. Obviously, he is kind of adopted into the U.S. military. He works for the U.S. military. He's very much in the white world, but eventually kind of returns to his ancestral world. How does he deal with these two worlds? And then what are these two worlds he's inhabiting?
Well, as you say, the first of them is after his family is killed and after his people are massacred there at the cave, the soldiers take Burns back with them to their post, and their main post is a place called Camp Whipple, later Fort Whipple, which is now just outside of modern-day Prescott. Arizona. Well, the commander of the unit that he that has taken him is a man named James Burns, who's an immigrant from Ireland, who is now a captain in the army, and Burns adopts him. And by adopt, you know, I don't mean to say that he affords him a loving home with a bedroom and stuffed animals or things like that. It's more he adopts him as kind of a houseboy. You know, here you go, run down the hill and fetch the water and all that. James Burns has two children, a son and a daughter, who it's pretty clear they don't spend a lot of time together, young Mike Burns and the two Burns children. But nonetheless, for the next few years, he lives in the household and he's part of them. And he comes to think of himself as James Burns's son. And apparently James Burns encourages him in that, because James Burns, according to Mike Burns, says, you know, when all of this unpleasantness is over, I'm going to take you back to Ireland and introduce you to my family, and you will come and see your native country there in Ireland with my native country, and you will partake of our fortune and so on and so forth. Well, it's not the way it worked out. James Burns moved his family back to Washington, D.C., and he didn't leave a forwarding address. And then he himself began to move toward Washington, D.C., and unfortunately died of some illness en route. But meanwhile, Mike Burns is left back behind at the post. And for the next several years, in late childhood and into early teendom, he's basically the ward of these cavalry troops who are very kind to him, and they buy him when he's a little kid, they buy him a sailor suit, and when he's older, they buy him tobacco, you know, that kind of thing. And but even so, he's growing up not knowing much about his people. He's growing up speaking a kind of a broken English, and as the years roll by, he's more and more removed from any Cuevcapaya people. And it's not until, well, the end of this book, basically, that he is in a situation where he's back in the Indian world, and that is to say that after having been in the white world until well into his 20s, then suddenly he finds himself on the reservation, and with the sense that that's the only thing that's open to him is here's where you are. And so from the late 1880s, roughly, until the end of his life, there Burns is on the reservation. Mm. And again, he hasn't grown up among his very people. And there's a kind of a touching moment in the book where he talks about some of the folk tales, you know, the creation stories of the Cuevcapaya people, that he says, my wife's family told these stories to me. He would have known them growing up in ordinary circumstances, but he had to wait until he was an adult to be taught them. So he really and truly was a liminal character inhabiting two different worlds, or on the border between two different worlds, never at home in either one. And I give an example of the manuscript, the original manuscript that he wrote, which is in a kind of a fragmentary English that it's clear he's sort of thinking in some version of the Cuevcapaya language and putting it down in some version of English. But the very words on paper show to me that he really was between those two worlds.
This question is stepping back a little bit, but I was thinking about it as you were describing this, and I'm wondering if you can speculate at least, what is going on for the cavalrymen who, I mean, if they had come across young Mike Burns in the camp at Skeleton Cave, he would have been killed with the rest of them. But they were quite kind to him when he was among them. And it seems like an interesting I don't know, contradiction in sorts that, you know, you have U.S. soldiers who are willing and do exhibit incredible and indiscriminate violence against Native people. But they're, on the other hand, you know, treating this young Yavapai child as one of their own. What do you make of that?
Well, I don't see that as being a real outlier, and although I'm going to work myself into a position of trouble here, but I want to say that I believe that in the overall context of Western history, the greatest indiscriminate damage done to Native people would have been done by civilians. Ordinary miners and farmers and settlers who are in Indian territory who, as I say, shoot anything that moves.
Right.
The soldiers are, at this very moment, in fact, are under orders not to kill women and children. And I don't think that they're deliberately killing women and children at that point, although certainly there would have been incidents of that. Now, that said, we need to step back and sort of consider what happens in warfare generally, and there are incidents from and reports from the front today in Afghanistan of terrible crimes that are done. So I don't think that these things are rare. But on the other hand, as I say, the Bork himself said at that point we were trying to avoid killing women and children, but couldn't. I mean, basically, you know, there was no way to distinguish them from the heights above, and they certainly weren't going to hold their fire and wait for the opportunity to surrender at that point, too. And that's the kind of thing we can look back and at this juncture 125, 150 years later and say, well, why not? And we don't know the answer.
Sure.
To it, but there are one of Burns' cousins, for example, very similar circumstances raised up by a family in Chicago, and he becomes a very noted doctor named Carlos Montezuma,
sure.
Another Yavapai. Again, same circumstances, you know, family massacred, adopted, and just happened to have had the good fortune to be encouraged by his adoptive parents to go to medical school and to become a real leader of the Yavapai people in the early 20th century.
Mm-hmm. And that's the same Montezuma who goes on to write against and protest against the treatment by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Is that right?
Exactly so. Yeah, he became a very strong early critic of the BIA.
Sure. Fast forwarding now in time, I apologize for jumping back and forth here, but...
That's okay. Burns does all the time in his book.
Yeah,
so.
Sure. Why do you think, what led Mike Burns to write this story, to write this autobiography, and when does he do it in his life?
The question ultimately of why, I think, is probably bound up in a couple of things. And one is he had been encouraged to tell his story. He obviously was a genial man and an affable one, and he made friends very easily. And obviously, I say obviously, just if you read the book, you'll get the sense that he's a good storyteller, and he liked to tell stories. And so he found himself in that position as an elder, and he got to know some of the whites in the community or the surrounding support community on the reservation. One of the people that he got to know was an army surgeon named Joseph Corbusier. And he and the surgeon helped him sort of frame his story with the idea that he would write a book that would then sell. He also wrote a book, he also met a man named Henry Farish, who was an early historian of Arizona, and all these people encouraged him to write his story. And we don't know whether they encouraged him by means of it's really important that you sit down and tell your tale, or they encouraged him as in, you know, stop bothering me and go off and, you know, and just right and leave me alone. We don't quite know which one of those is true. But whatever the case, Mike Burns, along about 1920, let's say, bought a typewriter. And he sat in his room with his typewriter and told himself these stories and wrote out his his memoir at very considerable length and in the order that it occurred to him. And I want to say that all of that is unusual in the great context of 19th and early 20th century American Indian literature and memoir. We don't have any other auto-generated, I suppose you might say, self-generated autobiographies. What we have are a lot of as told to white historians or white journalists, in the case of Geronimo, for example, who would sit and Geronimo dictated to a man named Barrett his autobiography, for example. And we don't know what happened in between the words that Geronimo uttered and Barrett wrote down. We don't know, no other person is on hand to act as a corrector or to give a second account. In this case, we do have Burns directly on paper. We know his words there. So that makes his piece unusual in itself. So his memoir is, he writes his memoir then over the course of the next 10 or 15 years and, bits and pieces of it here and there and bits and pieces of it get out and become known, often borrowed by, usually white storytellers, or historians. The aforementioned Farish puts a couple of pieces, from Burns in his, multi-volume History of Arizona, which is published in the 1920s, anyway. And so I think Burns's motivation is not just to tell his story, but again, the hope of making some money. One of the interesting passages to me of the book is he's again writing of John Gregory Bourke, who I mentioned. And Bourke wrote a best-selling book called On the Border with Crook. And it sold, tens and tens of thousands of copies back in its day. And Burns says at a couple of points in the book, Bourke said he would give me some money because I helped him with telling the Yavapai story, but I never heard from him again.
So it was time to write his own, it sounds like.
I think so. And sadly, for all the encouragement that he received, and finally, Charlotte Hall, who was the territorial historian of Arizona, Burns approached her and said, would you please publish my book? And Charlotte Hall, to trust Burns's account, said, oh, yes, I will. I will do everything I can. And then, again, to trust Burns's account, if we look in the archives, we see a lot of paper streaming from Burns to Charlotte Hall and no paper streaming back. Mm. So whether Charlotte Hall just had other things to do or wasn't really serious in helping Burns or what, again, we don't know. But whatever the case, his memoir wound up in a archival dust-proof box in the basement of a museum in Arizona, and there it sat for 80 years until I came to it.
Wow. Was there any mention of it in the historical record over that 80 years, so far as you can tell, or was it pretty much unknown?
Oh, yeah. A few scholars had known about it, again, pointed to it largely by Farish, and Charlotte Hall had mentioned it and said, here it is, here's the manuscript available. And so from time to time, scholars would come up and make use of it and sometimes photocopy it. The manuscript was in a bit of a mess. There were several drafts that Burns wrote out over the years, and they were all by the time I got to the manuscript, they were all kind of jumbled together, and quite often the pages were not numbered. And so you would go from one page, you know, in the middle of a sentence, and then turn the page and be in another one that did not connect in any way. And some of my work in editing this book was kind of that jigsaw puzzle work of where does this fit in relation to the overall story, and trying to make sense and trying to reconcile multiple drafts that, again, were all jumbled up. There is one edition of the called an autobiography of a Yavapai Indian, and I will say in some anger and some disgust that it was an Anglo who came in, photocopied the manuscript as was, slapped it between covers, put a price tag on of $35, had the audacity to put a copyright on it.
Wow.
And then has sold the book. And that person who knows who she is persona non grata, as far as I'm concerned, anywhere in Arizona, although I'm not the emperor of the place, but certainly ought to be ashamed to show her face anywhere near Yavapai country.
Was it difficult to get around that? I mean, when you decided to publish this in an obviously more rigorous and respectful manner, was it difficult to get around that copyright?
Well, strictly speaking, there was no copyright on the book. I mean, by the copyright laws of the time, it would have been in the public domain. Which is an entirely different story.
You know?
In all events, well, as I say, 10 years ago, the then director of the Charlotte Hall Museum, where this manuscript was housed, came to me and asked me to have a look and to see if there was a story in there. And when I cracked open that archival box and started to get into it, I was astonished by the quality of the book. Previous generations of scholars, I think, had made use of it. And had made very good use of the manuscript, but I don't think anybody had ever stopped to say, "Hey, this is a good book. You know, this would make a great book on its own." And that was from my point of view where I came in, and I thought Mike Burns wanted his story told. He wanted to tell his story, and here we have the opportunity now, even if it is 80 years after his death, to do so, and to do so in again, as I hope, a respectful way, to get the word out about this man and the remarkable life that he lived, and his remarkable mind. I mean, this is I've lived with this manuscript for 10 years now, and I am constantly impressed by the quality of Mike Burns' mind and by the quality of his character. Would have liked to have known the man.
Yeah. Sure. Well, as we get close to the end of our discussion, I'm just wondering what did you find most surprising in this autobiography, or what do you think that readers would find most surprising when they pick up a copy of this book?
One of the most interesting things to me about Burns is his, if this means anything to you, his Zelig-like quality. And by that I'm referring to the Woody Allen movie, sure. Zelig, which is sort of picked up in the Forrest Gump movie about a guy who just happens to be everywhere at the right time. And Burns is everywhere at the right time. And again, as I say, sometimes it doesn't chronologically add up, strictly speaking, but it's close enough. And so, for example, Burns he's in New York City as the Brooklyn Bridge is being built. And he's standing there on the banks of the East River looking at this and marveling at the wonder of it and marveling at the skyscrapers. And then going to Chicago, he is a constant traveler between these two worlds. And within the space of a very short time, he is chasing after Sitting Bull on the so-called starvation march, you know, after Little Bighorn, as the Sioux and Cheyenne are slowly retreating northward into... eventually for Sitting Bull and the Hunkpapa Sioux, they're going to cross the border into Canada. to essentially declare themselves political to seek political asylum, so they're not killed. But there's the cavalry chasing Sitting Bull, and there's Mike Burns along with them. And there he is then in the middle of Oklahoma writing the mail, and he's in a little town in Ohio growing corn for a couple of years on the banks of the Ohio River. And, you know, he's just everywhere at once. And as he travels, he's constantly awake. He's constantly aware of everything, and he's constantly making notes. And one of the themes, I suppose, of the book, and Burns is not a complainer by any stretch, but he is someone who keeps a very careful account in his head of who has done him right and who has done him wrong. And he is very plain as things go along to say, yeah, you know, that person did me wrong, and that person did me a favor, and I owe a lot to that person. One of his favorite sort of quiet insults, I suppose you might say, is to call somebody a good Christian. Because most of the good Christians he encounters are anything but. So, but I think overall the surprise is, I hope that readers will, and I don't mean to sound self-serving with this, but I hope that readers will come away thinking, the biggest surprise of all being, why didn't I know about this guy before? Because this is primary reportage and primary accounting of experiences that we've all heard about, but always from the Anglo side, always from our side. And to hear about them from the native point of view, you know, that famous anthropological phrase, is really quite eye-opening and really quite wonderful.
I should also mention to readers that in all those amazing places that, you've mentioned he was also at Carlisle Indian School, at West Point Academy. He was sitting and having a conversation with Richard Henry Pratt, the famous or infamous founder of the Carlisle Indian School. So, you know, this conversation has just touched the tip of the iceberg about what is in this work. Well, I've been speaking with Gregory McNamee, who has, again, recently released this wonderful autobiography of Mike Burns entitled The Only One Living to Tell. It's out from the University of Arizona Press. And by way of closing, Greg, I'm hoping you can, and you've mentioned a little bit of this, but I'm hoping you can just talk about why you think this is important to engage with. You know, the importance for students of history, for Americans, for Native Americans, to listen and engage with voices like Mike Burns that they might not, and in fact, they won't get from their standard history textbook.
And that is precisely the point, to have all of this lived experience before us, and to have accounts of at the heart of the book of is Mike Burns' service as a scout in the United States Cavalry, as an Indian scout going to find other Indians for the cavalry, either to kill or to remove. And that moral dilemma is, I think, that's a subject for of worth great discussion. I would like to think that classrooms in the future, there will be a lot of conversation about that. How could that happen? How could one Indian go to war against another in that kind of way? To have Burns' account of the why of that is a fascinating thing. We don't have it from any other source. And so that makes it an important document. It makes it an important document, I think, the mere fact, as I said, that this is not an as-told-to, but a direct account by somebody who lived all of these things, sets the book apart from many others. And we have a wonderful tradition of Native American memoir with people, books mostly about. And I can think, for example, of Geronimo's story, again, by put down on paper by S.M. Barrett, and then the life of Sarah Winnemucca, and then Ishii, the last of his tribe.
How about Black Elk Speaks? That's probably the most famous, and that's very much an as-told-to and filtered filtered story, Black Elk.
Exactly. So, and in fact, I kind of hesitated to mention that because that book is so problematic many different ways. And Burns is not, and I will open the door to some future dissertation by saying the only interference in the Burns book is the interference that I've brought into it, just as his editor and his interpreter. So in that, I want to say that I did, as I say, a lot of reordering of elements in the book just to make the story a little more coherent chronologically. And I streamlined some of the language and made it a little bit easier to understand. But I took pains throughout never to use a word that Burns himself did not use. There. So trying to make this a thoroughly readable, thoroughly accessible, and thoroughly understandable book on one hand, while preserving as much of Burns as possible in it. So so it really is, it's a document not quite like any other that we have had so far. I would like to think that this will open the door and that somebody will take the time to go and look in all the archives out there and find more of these books, because I'm sure there are more of them. We just don't know about them.
Sure. Now, before I let you go, a man who's published over 30 books is surely working on something, or at least thinking about working on something next. What are you thinking about publishing next? What are you writing?
Well, I'm launching myself into the 21st century by working on a series of electronic books right now, having to do with renewable energy, and it's a tangled thing, but a long tail lies in it. But I've been working with some consultants, basically having to do with trying to figure out how we can all get back to work and stop digging up the mountains that Mike Burns worked so hard to preserve. Sure. And so that's what I'm doing now.
Wonderful. Well, I encourage people to go to your website, which we'll link to, and follow the work that you're doing. Gregory McNamee, thank you so much for joining me on New Books in Native American Studies today.
It's been a privilege, Andrew. Thank you for having me.
Thanks. You've been listening to an interview with Gregory McNamee, editor of The Only One Living to Tell, the autobiography of a Yavapai Indian by Mike Burns from the University of Arizona Press. We're on the web at newbooksinnativeamericanstudies.com, where you can listen to all the past podcasts. You can also find us on iTunes, Facebook, and Twitter. If you like our Facebook page, you can post questions, comments, or suggestions for new books you'd like to hear discussed on this program. For the New Books Network, I'm Andrew Epstein, and I hope you join us again next month for another new book in Native American Studies. Thanks.